snakes and plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, golden calves and the tabernacle, the ultimate showdown between Moses and Pharaoh, let my people go, cloud by day, pillar of fire by night, 10 commandments, Passover, and that's not even the half of it. We will be attempting to work our way through the entire book of Exodus in 1 hour on today's episode of Theology on Air. Well, welcome back to Theology on Air. I am Sarah Stone. I'm the Outreach Director for Young Adults at MDPC and joined with by Evan McClanahan, Senior Pastor at First Lutheran in Midtown, Houston, and a guest that you might recognize because he's been on the show before. He's our resident Indiana Jones. He's an archaeologist and a professor and a theologian and an apologist, and he has good hair. For those of you watching, if you're on the podcast, you'll just have to take our word for it. But Ted Wright is our guest today to help us walk through the book of Exodus. The podcast is wanting to once a month tackle a different book of the Bible, kind of survey what were the high points, what's the strange stuff. And we're going to be doing that today. But first, you need to subscribe to Theology on Air. If you haven't already done it, why not? My goodness. That's the first thing you need to do right now. Just pause us, go and subscribe. You will win fabulous prizes. We don't actually have prizes yet, but you know, in your heart, you'll feel good about your decision. So YouTube, any podcast platform. And if you want to learn more about us, you can also go to our website, houstontot.com. And you can also find out about events that we're having live. We've got a virtual something or other coming up in March, but then we have our live first back foray into maybe post-COVID life in April. So very exciting stuff.
And apparently you just told me Iowa's opening up. So we're actually going to do a Houston TOT event in Iowa next week.
Okay. Evan will be there. All right. And funny. All of our Iowan fans, anyway, we might have some.
I take it all back.
Okay. Anyway, so today we're tackling Exodus, and it's a huge, I mean, so much stuff happens in Exodus, but it seems like first we should kind of establish where we find ourselves in the whole biblical narrative at the beginning of Exodus. So Ted, why don't you just kind of get us into the beginning of Exodus? What has happened at the end of Genesis and why does it matter? How does it tie together? Start us off and then we're going to try to hit the high points as we go.
Sure. Thanks, Sarah. So what years ago when I started teaching Old Testament survey back in North Carolina, I was teaching at SES. And when you first start teaching the Old Testament, you have to cover the entire Old Testament in a whole semester, which is very difficult to do. We're going to try to cover a book today in 1 hour. But so I had to try to think of ways to explain entire books in like just a couple of hours and try to go through all the material. So at the time I was teaching it, the series Lord of the Rings was just released by Peter Jackson, you know, the film series. And so a lot of people have read the books, Lord of the Rings, or they've seen the movies. So what I taught my Old Testament students is that when we look at the Old Testament, it's really what I've given them is like what I call keys to the Old Testament. And the way I would explain Exodus is really it fits into a larger narrative of the entire Old Testament. So, but it really is part of a 5-part book series, just like Lord of the Rings has 3 books. The first part of the Bible that we call the Torah, or the Pentateuch, is Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. So Exodus is part of this story in the first part of the Bible. So you can read it by itself and it makes sense, just like you can read Lord of the Rings by itself and it makes sense, but it's also part of a bigger story. So when we read things in the Exodus, there's references to stuff in the previous material. So just like in Lord of the Rings. So one of the things that we notice in Hebrew literature is something that an English reader doesn't really get on a first reading. You can read an English translation of the Exodus and understand everything in it, but there are some things that I think English readers need to know about Hebrew literature and how the biblical writers wanted to emphasize things. And so this will make sense as I kind of work through it. So like, for instance, if you're typing a text, you know, everybody knows that when you're sending a text, you don't send a text in all caps, because what does that mean? I mean, if you're sending
a text. I mean, what are you trying to accomplish? Are you yelling at someone?
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're sending a text in all caps, you're yelling at someone, or there's different ways to emphasize things. in a text or in a letter and things like that. Well, the Hebrews didn't have, of course, their writing in Hebrew, and they would want to emphasize things in different ways. So there's something called parallelisms, in which you would parallel some one thing with another thing. You can compare and contrast. And then there's something else that I think your previous guest that we're talking about Genesis, I think he may have touched on this, I'm not sure, but something called a chiasm. And I don't know if you guys have talked about chiasms before.
I always pronounce it chiasm. No?
Chiasm, chiasm. It's the Greek word chi or chi.
These are the things we need to nail down.
Come on, we got to keep moving.
Okay, sorry. Okay. Chiasm, chiasm. Keep going.
So in any case, there are chiasms, and then there are also historical ironies. So things that are talked about in Genesis are emphasized in Exodus. So let me give you some, and this will carry us over into Exodus. So for instance, there's some interesting things that are going on in Genesis as far as numbers go. So in the creation account, when God creates the universe, he says, let there be light. He creates, he says, God speaks and it's so, and God speaks and it's so. So 10 times God creates, he speaks the word and he creates the world. So there are words, 10 words of creation in the creation account. But then there are only two instances in which God says that things are not good, that he says that it's not good for man to be alone. And all the men said, amen. And the other thing he said that's not good is that it's not good for the man and the woman to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So there are implications for God's word. When God speaks, God's words can be words of creation, or they can be words of destruction. And so interestingly, in the Exodus, there are how many plagues?
Ten.
So there are 10. So this is an interesting parallel between the 10 words of creation in Genesis and the 10 words of destruction in the Exodus when God speaks the plagues in the book of Exodus. But I'm jumping ahead of myself. But I'm
and
just
then
trying
there's
to
10 commandments.
Exactly. That's right, Sarah. That's Perfect exactly sense. Right. That's right. And so what we think this is going on here is that God is trying to emphasize something in these groups of 10. That he's trying to emphasize that, remember what I did back in Genesis? I spoke the universe. Well, God is doing something new in the Exodus. God is speaking words, a new life. He's giving the law, the Torah, and this law is life. In fact, God says, I'm going to, in Leviticus later, he's going to say, if you obey my law and you obey my voice, I will come and dwell with you and I will live with you and I will be your God and you will be my people. So this is, the Exodus is what I would call the salvific event of the Old Testament. In fact, Walter Kaiser, an Old Testament professor, said that there are over 700 references to the Exodus or to Egypt in the entire Bible. And 125 of those references had to do with the phrase, in fact, they're couched in the phrase, I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land mm-hmm. of Egypt. So the Exodus is not just some throwaway thing that we think, well, you know, what do you think about the Exodus? You know, I think it might happen. No, it's indispensable for Old Testament theology.
Have done a ton of research about kind of archaeological evidences and textual evidences for the Exodus, which we're going to get to in a little bit. But let's just, for the sake of the fact that we're trying to cram all this into an hour, let's just kind of walk through sort of the first bullet points of things that happen. I mean, we've ended Genesis with Joseph has now brought Jacob and the rest of the family, which are the sort of parents of the Israelite family, all the tribes, and they're in Egypt because there was a famine and all that jazz. You can go back and listen to the other podcast about that, but they're in Egypt and the Hebrews are multiplying like a lot. In fact, I think in verse 7, the Exodus passage really harkens back to the Genesis passage about being fruitful and multiplying, as it says that's right. The Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. And the Egyptians were not big fans of that. And we've crossed over into some new pharaohs now. And the pharaoh, talk to us about the pharaoh that we find ourselves in when baby Moses comes on the scene.
Very interesting. And let me, and before I get to that, Sarah, let me just touch on something that you just mentioned about, you talked about Jacob and the Israelites multiplying in Egypt. Well, we have to mention, because it figures into the Exodus, we have to mention not only Jacob, but also Abraham. So there were covenants, there were promises that were given to Abraham in Genesis. They were unconditional covenants. So God made this covenant with Abraham. He says, I'm going to make you into a great nation and I'm going to multiply you and you're going to be great. You're going to be a blessing to the entire earth. This is in Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 22. In fact, forward later, thousands of years later in the book of Romans, Paul says that Abraham believed God and God credited that to him for righteousness. So Abraham was the father of faith, but he was also, his descendants were going to be the physical descendants in which God was going to choose to work to bless all nations. So by the time we come to the end of Genesis, they have now multiplied. They're now in Egypt because of a famine. And now, by the time we come to Exodus, we have this Pharaoh who really didn't recognize the Israelites. He didn't recognize that there was a special relationship when they entered into Egypt under this famine. And so, interestingly, there was, based on the chronology that I follow and that I have done research on, not just myself, but also colleagues that I follow as well, we believe that the Exodus, there are two basic dates for the Exodus. So one is the early date, and the other one is the late date. So the early date would be like 1446 BC, and the late date would be something like 1236, 1237 BC under Ramesses II. And we don't have time to get into all the details of that.
No.
But I'm just going to say that if our chronology is correct on the early Exodus date, that would mean that Moses would have been in Egypt sometime during the reign or during the time of a very fascinating Egyptian queen by the name of Hatshepsut. And it's kind of easy to say her name if you think about it in different segments. So Hatshepsut. Hat, like a hat, Shep, S-H-E-P-S-U-T, Hatshepsut. And she was quite remarkable. She would have been a teenage girl when Moses was born and very likely pulled him from the Nile. Interestingly, Sarah and Evan, there's some really interesting archaeological evidence also that indicates that she may have been instrumental in bringing the Israelites into Pharaoh's household, because later in Thutmose III's reign, we find all of her inscriptional evidence that's been chiseled off of the stones in Egypt. And so some archaeologists surmise that either Amenhotep II or a later pharaoh, because of the calamity that happened in Egypt, erased her name off of her monuments in Egypt. And she created one of the largest mortuary temples in the Valley of the Kings near Thebes called Deir el-Bari. And all of her names were chiseled. That's significant because in Egyptian religion, the way that they obtained eternal life was to have their name chiseled in stone. So when you chisel their name off, it's like erasing their name from the Lamb's Book of Life, if you will.
For them, so, but it's for significant them. For us, because it points to the fact that there was something really embarrassing for the Egyptians that happened, but we're getting ahead of ourselves, because we are basically, we're kind of starting our story for our purposes, 400 years, right? Mm-hmm. After we left off. And the bad Pharaoh who we find ourselves under, Amenhotep II probably, has enslaved the Hebrew. I mean, well, they've been enslaved this whole time, but he has this new edict that they're getting unruly in their numbers. And so the edict is that all of the baby boys are supposed to be thrown into the Nile. And it's a terrible thing. And so baby Moses is born. And if you ever heard the Sunday school story, they put him in a basket and they do throw him in the Nile, turns out. Like they weren't real. It was like a loophole. Well, they didn't throw him, but they placed him in a basket, which I think, Ted, you're the one that told me that the basket that gets placed in the Nile, that's the same word that's only used one other place in the Old Testament, which is the ark.
Both times,
it's a vessel for being in the water and being saved and bringing salvation to God's people. But anyway, just a fun little fact for you. So Moses goes downstream, gets found by Hatshepsut, right?
Yep.
And of course, Miriam, his sister, is waiting in the reeds and says, oh, do you need a nurse or someone to care for him? And they go and they essentially bring his mom in under the guise of someone to help, you know? And so he gets to grow up both with his family in some sense and in Egypt with Egyptian culture and in the palace, right? So he grows up. Walk us through what happens when he becomes an adult, and we're gonna have to go at lightning speed.
Okay, so just to be clear, when Moses was born, it wasn't Amenhotep II. That was later in his life. But in any case, I get what you're saying. But so he grows up as the stepbrother of Thutmose III, and Hatshepsut and Thutmose III are co-regents. So he is a little boy when his father dies prematurely. The father dies early. So she has to reign as the Pharaoh, and she presents herself as a male Pharaoh, and she raises Thutmose III
and Moses. That's a cool thing.
And Moses. And Moses together. So Moses eventually murders an Egyptian and has to flee Egypt. And so
because the Egyptian was mistreating an Israelite and abusing him, it wasn't like he was like, what would be fun to do today? Murder.
I've often wondered though, did Moses know he was an Israelite? Is that a stupid question?
No, he absolutely knew.
Yes, he did. No, that's right. He did.
Okay. And how would he have known?
Because for like 12 years, he was raised by his mom.
Okay. Because of the familial connection in the court. So they would have been pulling him off to the side and being like, well, you know, you're really da 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 da.
Actually, don't some people think that he actually was raised in his home and then brought to the court when he was like a real man at age 12 or something?
What does the scripture say? What does Acts 7 say?
I don't have Acts memorized, Ted. You tell us what it says.
Acts 7 is when Stephen is talking to Sanhedrin, and it says that Moses was trained in all the ways and the culture of the Egyptians. So he was a man of power and word and deed. So if Stephen is right in Acts 7, Moses would have been reared in the household of Pharaoh. In fact, interestingly, the word Pharaoh means household, and it's a royal household. And so he would have been reared. That's, I think, the correct word, not raised, but he would have been reared as an Egyptian. But Sarah, you're right. He definitely would have known about his Hebrew heritage, very likely from his mother, his sister, and his surrounding family. But he would also trained as an Egyptian as well, and would have known a diplomatic language like Akkadian at the time. He would have been able to read hieroglyphics. He would have been knowledgeable, probably of engineering and architecture and a lot of the Egyptian religion at the time.
But he had a soft spot for the Hebrew people.
Definitely.
Because he understood himself as a Hebrew. So when he sees the violence against the Hebrew person, he kills the Egyptian. Okay. And so for that reason, he himself is fleeing, exodusing.
So by this time, and this is a good point to interject, when he does kill the Egyptian, Moses, now Hatshepsut had already passed away, and now Thutmose III is now reigning as the Pharaoh in Egypt. And so there, Moses is, according to the chronology, Moses would have been probably 2 or 3 years older than Thutmose III. And we know a lot about him through Egyptian history and archaeology. There's a lot of inscriptional evidence about him. And historians and archaeologists consider Thutmose III to be the Napoleon of Egypt. He did 17 campaigns into Palestine, into Canaan. And the reason why these pharaohs would do this is they would actually go in to get slaves to actually do the work in Egypt. So this is significant because it was his son when Moses goes to Midian for 40 years to live with Jethro and the Midianites. And he, of course, gets a wife there, and he's keeping the flocks, he's tending the flocks, and that's where God appears to him in Midian. Thutmose III is doing his thing. And so he eventually dies. And when he dies, then Moses goes back to Egypt, and then he confronts Amenhotep II. And there's a lot of historical connections that really dovetail perfectly with the fact that Amenhotep II would have been the Exodus Pharaoh. I'll give you one just right off the top of my head here, and that is that in most of the kings of the 18th dynasty, which is the dynasty of pharaohs that Moses, with the time frame of the Exodus, they all had their capital in Thebes. And if you know anything about Egyptian geography, Thebes is way to the south near Sudan, which is in modern day Africa. Way down in the southern part of the Nile, whereas Amenhotep II had his capital in Memphis, which is not Tennessee, but Memphis, Egypt, in the northern part of Egypt, right close to the Nile Delta or Goshen, which is where Moses and Aaron would have been. So the history matches exactly what we'd have known about in Moses' day.
Okay, so you mentioned, he's fled, he's in Midian, he finds a wife, he's with this lovely man named Jethro and his family, hang in for a while till there's a transfer of power, as it were. And then there's this thing that happens that, again, maybe a Sunday school story, the burning bush. Walk us through the burning bush story. And I think Evan maybe had something he wanted to say about this as well.
It really is one of the, in the whole Exodus narrative, Exodus 3 is one of the pivotal events of that whole narrative, besides the Red Sea crossing. I think it's the Exodus 3 is really important because of what Moses actually does. He confronts, and there's a lot of interesting conjecture about the burning bush, and we can get into a rabbit trail on that. And I know that Joe Rogan, who does the podcast, he thinks that Moses would have took some hallucinogenic drugs, and that the burning bush was like a mushroom trip or something. But that's not what it was. It was a essentially the bush was not consumed. It was that the fire did not consume this green bush. And there's been a lot of conjecture. Scholars say that there's a bush in the Near East that actually looks like it's on fire. Sometimes it can smoke. That's neither here nor there, and it doesn't change the effect of it. But the point is that Moses met with God face to face, or as close as he can come, to this burning bush, and he calls him by name, and he tells him, "You're going to go back to Egypt, and you're going to get my people out." Mm-hmm. And here's where it gets really interesting. So Evan, you I think wanted to ask a question about this, but let me just work through it real quick. Mm-hmm. And he says, basically, Moses says, "So when I go back to Egypt, and I tell them, that God sent me, what should I tell him your name is?" Because, which I think is very interesting, because it's like, what's your name? You know, I don't know what your name is. And this is what the answer that God gave. He says, "I am that I am." So he starts out by saying, "I am." And then we often stop there, but he continues mm-hmm. on, and God says, "I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. This is my name forever, the name by which I shall be remembered from generation to generation." So God, what I think mm-hmm. is going on with the divine name is that, remember now, if we're right about Israel being in Egypt, they're there in Egypt for 430 years, and they have become almost thoroughly paganized in Egyptian culture. They would have been mm-hmm. influenced by polytheism, henotheism, Egyptian animism, all those kinds of things. And we know that they were, because when they did finally escape, they worshiped a golden calf. So God says, I exist. There's no other like me. And he's connected his eternal nature with the promises that he gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So in other words, God remembered the covenant that he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it's interesting because there's a parallel and back in Genesis and the chiasm or the structure of the flood narrative that centers on Genesis 8 verse 1, which says God remembered Noah. God remembered Noah. God remembers when he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. So by the time we come to Exodus 3, God remembers the covenant that he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And now he's going to send Moses back, and he's going to deliver them with a mighty hand.
Excellent.
Pretty cool.
So Moses, and then there's a little bit more to that conversation, because he's a little wigged out about being the one guy. Maybe he has a stutter or something. So he says, you can take your brother, right? Aaron. Anyway, so he and Aaron go back to Egypt, and they start basically this long-term showdown between Moses and Pharaoh. And we don't have time to get into all of it, but it's a great read. So you can go and read that in your own Bible. There's snakes involved, but basically, Pharaoh keeps saying, "No, no, no, I'm not letting these people go. They're my slaves and I need them and you're stupid." And then Moses says, "No, no, no, no. Look, I have God on my side." And they go back and forth some. And there's, I don't know how many times this happens, but the Bible keeps saying this thing. The first few times it says that Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And then in the subsequent ones, it says something like, "And God hardened Pharaoh's heart." Because we keep thinking, it's like the highs and lows of this movie we're watching, where you think like, he's going to let him go. Oh, he's not. Oh, now he is. No. And then that's even before the plagues. And then during the plagues, you keep thinking, which we'll get to in a second, that they'll, you know, be let go. But talk to us a little bit. I think unbelievers and skeptics and even many Christians have a problem with this phrase, right? That God would harden someone's heart and makes it sound like they don't have any say in it. And why would God do that? Because then later he's going to get in trouble for doing this thing. Would God do that to us? Talk us through that wording a little bit so we can understand what's happening there, the hardening of the heart.
So there's a two-part answer that I want to give. First, I'll give the theological answer. I'll give a theological apologetic answer. And then I'm going to go back and give an answer from ancient history and what we know of Egyptology and what we know of the cultural context in which
that's most, the Indiana Jones answer. The second
that's right.
One.
Yeah, okay, the cool. Indiana Jones answer. So the first, the theological answer is that whenever sometimes it'll say, in fact, this not only does God harden Pharaoh's heart, but also the Bible also says in other places that God repented, that God changed his mind. Whereas other mm-hmm. passages, it says that God doesn't change his mind. So which one is it? Does God change his mind or does God not change? So this is anthropomorphic language to describe what actually happens when God's actions in history are played out. His actions will harden some people's hearts, whereas they will soften some people's hearts. So there's a phrase that somebody said years ago, and I forgot who said this, basically the same sun that melts the wax will harden the clay. So mm-hmm. same actions that God does. So by God giving these plagues, the action is ultimately from God, but Pharaoh was hardening his heart. So he's responsible for the hardening of the heart, but yet God is also responsible in the fact that God is giving the plague. So you could probably get into that a little bit more with Paul Copan. I know he's probably going to be a future guest on, on Theology on Air, but he can get into more about that because he's written some great stuff on this, on the genocide question and things like that.
Yeah.
So that's one part of the answer. The second part of it is this, to go back to a reference I made earlier in Acts chapter 7, where Stephen tells us, he actually tells the Pharisees that Moses was trained in all the ways of the Egyptians, which means that Moses would have understood Egyptian culture. And one of the indicators that the Exodus is an authentic narrative, that it actually was not invented and made up, well, it comes from two areas. I think internally in the text itself indicates that there are clues in the Exodus narrative that give
us— Let me pause you for a second, because I think you're not saying something that most people don't know is implied. And that is that we believe Moses wrote Exodus.
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Yeah, most traditional Christian scholarship holds to Mosaic authorship of the first five books of the Bible. And most critical liberal scholars today believe that the first five books were written primarily by four independent writers that they label J, E, D, and P. We don't go into that.
No, thank goodness. That's how we will bore our guests to death. But we believe Moses wrote it, which is key to what you're about to say, because he would have written knowing what.
Correct. That's right. Exactly. So if Moses was trained as an Egyptian, he would have understood Egyptian culture, Egyptian religion. And this gets into something that I'm going to throw a big seminary word out, and then I'll define it and we'll get away from it. But it's called polemical theology. And there's a really good book on this I have right here. It's by John Curd. It's called Against the Gods. If somebody wants to get deeper into that, it's about this polemical theology in the Old Testament that basically it's a cosmic confrontation between Yahweh, the Old Testament God of the Israelites, and all the Egyptian gods, as well as the Canaanite gods. And so so what we're talking about here, and we're talking about the serpent motif, right, or the hardening of the heart. In Egyptian religion, the heart is very important. And the reason why we know this is because of papyri that Egyptologists have translated through the years in the past centuries. And that is that we found something in something called the Egyptian Book of the Dead, which is a papyri manuscript that shows what happens in the afterlife when the Pharaoh dies. His heart is going to be weighed in a scale balance against a feather, a hieroglyphic feather that represents something called Ma'at, or the Egyptian idea of Ma'at means truth or righteousness or justice or goodness or whatever the case may be. So the hardening of the heart was very significant in Egyptian culture. In fact, so much so that today, this very day, you can go to Egypt and you could, if you dig around, you can find these little scarabs, which are these little beetles that are formed in clay, and they would place these beetles over the Pharaoh's heart in the mummy to keep it soft in the afterlife, because the heart was going to be weighed. If the heart was heavy or hard, then it was going to outweigh the feather of truth, and the Pharaoh would be condemned in the afterlife. So I think what's going on here is Moses is sort of knocking on the door of the minds of the not only the Israelites, but the Egyptians as well, saying, listen, you know that even in your own religion, the heart, you need to pay attention, listen to God and let us go free, because you don't want to harden your heart. You're hardening your heart. So Moses is speaking to Pharaoh directly in his own culture, which is, I think, truly remarkable.
Yeah. And we miss that when we read it today, and we miss all kinds. I mean, that beginning sort of, you know, cosmic trash talk continues through the plagues where, and maybe you can say something about this, but each of the 10 plagues isn't just some random weird, creepy EBGB thing that we now are like, flies, blood, gross. They were gross, but each of those is kind of addressing a different Egyptian god, right? That they served. And each time it's like God saying, oh, you believe this? I'll show you who is king of that, right?
That's exactly right, Sarah. And let me go back to something that you mentioned earlier, and that is the serpent, which is, I cannot overemphasize enough, if that's grammatically correct to say, the serpent, how important the serpent was, the imagery of the serpent. Anybody can just know, if you've ever seen a picture of King Tut, you know, the gold mask, what has he got on his crown? He's got a snake. Right. And that is the chief god of the Egyptians. It's called the Uraeus serpent. It's symbolic of, interestingly, wisdom, symbolic of eternal life, symbolic of knowledge. And what
I
are
was
we
just saying? Gonna say that sounds yeah. really familiar to something we talked about in Genesis.
Exactly. So the serpent comes up. Yep. And what's interesting is that when Moses and Aaron go before Pharaoh, he gets the staff and he throws it before Pharaoh, and it's literally the very emblem of Egypt itself. Hmm. And then of course Pharaoh's magicians throw their staffs down, and then Moses' staff consumes. What's interesting is that, I don't know if you guys ever heard this, and I just read it fairly recently, is that is the same exact Hebrew phraseology in the Hebrew, in the account where you've got Moses throwing the staff down and it consuming the staff of the Egyptians. When they come to the Red Sea, Moses holds that exact same staff up across the Red Sea, and it opens up, and then it consumes the armies.
The Egyptians.
Of yeah.
Oh, that's cool. Isn't that another cool? little nugget. Mm. Love it.
A lot of cool
Man.
Stuff.
We are paying you for good stuff here. We're not paying him, but yeah. he's giving us the good tidbits anyway.
But you should go to epicarchaeology.com.
Yes, we'll say that at the end as well. Okay. And we'll put it in the notes.
All right.
Okay, so there's these 10 plagues. Yes. You can read about them. But the very last one is the one that I want to wrestle with just a little bit before we get to the next part of the story. And oh my goodness, it's going to take a while.
Real fast. Did the Egyptians have 10 and only 10 gods, or were these the 10 like highest up or something?
BuzzFeed top 10.
Yeah.
Yes, they had multiple gods. They had, depending on what period of Egyptian history you go to, there are some that carry over. One of the ones that's very early in Egyptian history, in fact, one of their earliest gods is a cow god. That's the earliest because it had to do with fertility. In fact, in the earliest Egyptian records, we have the Egyptians worshiping the calf or the cow, the sacred cow, because of the fertility, not only of having babies, but also of having fertile crops and having the crops be successful. So those carry over into all the way into the mm-hmm. like the Roman period. But then you've got some that come and go. For instance, when we've got Akhenaten, who they call the heretic king, who worships the only one God, and people say, oh, he got that from the Israelites, and that's not the case at all. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, Evan, they had multiple gods, but there were several main gods that they had. And let me just mention also, since we're on this topic, that what's the very last plague? The very last plague.
Well, that's what I was about to get into.
Okay.
Yeah.
The last plague is, and you guys tell me, what was the last plague?
It was the killing of the firstborn.
That's right. And so, do you, either of you know which god that would have confronted, which one? Because we know, of course, the Nile had their own god, you know, the cows getting, you know, plague, they had the cow god. But what would the last plague would have been a knock on? Which god?
I really wish I knew the answer to this.
I'm guessing it's fertility if it's the firstborn.
No, the okay. Pharaoh himself.
Oh.
The head god. Here's the interesting thing. In Egyptian cosmology and Egyptian worldview, the Pharaoh is considered to be God's representative on earth. He was the God King. He was to be the one who was supposed to preserve life. In fact, Ma'at, M-A-A-T, this Egyptian idea of Ma'at, is that he preserved life. There are always these forces of chaos and forces of order that seek to overthrow Egypt. And so one of his divine missions as Pharaoh was to preserve Ma'at in Egypt, because there were seasonal floods and there were famines and different things like that. So he was commissioned by the gods to preserve life, and he could not even preserve the life of his own son. So this was a knock on Pharaoh himself, that he was not God, and that there was only one God, and that it is the God of the Hebrews. So I don't know if there were any other additional questions.
We sadly don't have time to get to all of those questions, but we'll just have to have you on again and do one just on the plagues or something. But that final plague is also a really key piece of the Old Testament and Jewish history, which is what we now call Passover, which is where God tells through Moses, the Israelites, this is about to happen. All of the eldest children, but not just littles, any eldest child is going to be killed. And if you want to escape this, this is what you need to do. You need to get a lamb and use the blood with a hyssop. I mean, there's all this kind of cool symbology that goes on into the New Testament, but put the blood of the lamb over your doors and the angel of death will pass over your houses so that you guys will be spared. And then of course, this is the final thing that makes Pharaoh finally say, fine, go. And he's so sad, of course, because he's lost his own son. But And Passover is just this wonderful, amazing story for the Jewish people. But I think a lot of skeptics read this and think, well, but what about everybody else? I mean, there were people that weren't Pharaoh. They're not involved in these negotiations. They're just regular people and they're losing their children or they're being lost. Like people are losing their husbands because that was the firstborn of their parents and cattle and all kinds of, I mean, like, how do we justify, and we don't have to get into a whole thing about the violence in the Old Testament now because we have, and we'll keep talking about that. But can you just give some kind of feedback to that criticism?
Yeah. I mean, I go back to this, as both of you know, I know you know this, the three most important rules in hermeneutics: context. Context is king. And we have to remember who this was written to originally. If we want to understand, we a lot of modern Christians want to jump immediately to application, immediately to how does this relate to today? But we have to understand first and foremost, what did it mean to the original Israelites? Because this was given to them for their edification. And you got to remember also that God had hundreds of years before, perhaps thousands of years before, had wiped out the entire earth, everybody in the flood. And because of the sin in mentioned in Genesis 6:1. So the fact of the matter is that this was in God. Here's the thing. It comes. So this is not a satisfactory answer to people who don't believe that there's a God and that don't believe in the scripture. But if there is a God and the God of the Old Testament is true, he's the true God, then what we learn and what we understand from Christian theology is that God is holy and that God is not only morally holy, he's also metaphysically holy. He is not like anything or anyone else. So God is the only being in the universe that has the divine right to execute judgment whenever he wants to. But there's also something called the age of accountability. And so if there were young people who passed away before the age of accountability, then they would have very likely went to heaven. But you got to remember, this was a judgment upon a sinful nation because of the decisions of one man. And so sadly, that happens today. You've got rulers today who make bad decisions, and there are consequences for those bad decisions. So there, the people, the firstborn, ended up dying because of the decision of this man. But of course, God is also just, and so he's not going to unduly send somebody to hell, you know, like little children, anything like that. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer, but that's...
It's the beginning of one, and that's all we really have time to do today, but we will keep talking about that kind of thing on the show, so keep listening to Theology on Air. But so, and the thing about Passover, of course, is that it's this giant arrow pointing to the New Testament when the spotless lamb, who is Jesus, will use his blood to save us, right?
That's right.
So this final plague happens. Pharaoh finally says, go. And millions of people leave Egypt, including, if I'm not mistaken, plenty of non-Israelites tag along. They realize they've seen the power displayed and they went in on the action. So anytime people are like, what about the non-Israelites? I'm like, they got invited all the time to come along for the ride. So this horde of people and all their stuff are making this, well, Exodus, and they are led. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, the next section and get us into the wilderness.
Okay. So the best evidence archaeologically that we have of where they were, where they would have left from, we know that the primary residence was probably in a place in the Nile Delta that it goes by the ancient name of Avaris or Tel El Daba. And there was an Austrian archaeologist that's excavated there for about 30 years. His name is Manfred B. Tack. There's good evidence archaeologically that there were non-Egyptian Asiatics who followed a certain dietary law. The reason why we know this is because of the bones that we find there. We don't find pig bones. There's these middens of bones that they left behind when they eat. And there's a certain type of structure that we find. And then in 1446 BC, this all goes blank archaeologically at Avaris.
Hmm.
So they leave there.
That's cool.
And they go and they move into the wilderness for 40 years. And they're wandering around for 40 years. But let me say this about Avaris. One other thing, too, that indicates that the Israelites were there. There's some work that's been done in the past 5 or 6 years or so. A colleague and friend of mine who's there in Texas in the Houston area with you guys, named Doug Petrovich, and he has done some really remarkable work on these inscriptions that were found in the Sinai Peninsula, which is that little triangular piece of land just south of Egypt, south of Goshen. They're in these turquoise mines. And so these inscriptions show up on these huge stone pillars that they're called stelae. And they're like, just imagine a giant tombstone with writing on them. And the writing is called the Proto-Sinaitic Inscriptions. And so to make a long story short, Petrovich has believed he has cracked the code in interpreting these inscriptions because they contain a language that scholars are not exactly sure what it is. It actually contains elements of Hebrew and elements of hieroglyphics, of Egyptian hieroglyphics. And he believes that this is actually the language of Proto-Hebrew that would have been inscribed by the Israelites when they're in Egypt. They show up about the time of Joseph, and just get this, guys, they disappear in 1446. These inscriptions, they don't show up anymore in Egypt, and then they disappear.
It's almost like it really happened.
It's almost like it really
happened. Crazy.
But if he's right, he's also translated several of them, and he has discovered the name of Moses and the name of Manasseh on these inscriptions. And if he's right, wow, this is gonna blow the lid off of archaeology. So it's quite.
Okay, so our archaeologist is very excited, but I'm going to continue moving us through the story because the Israelites are following a cloud by day, fire at night, and then there's the big story of the parting of the Red Sea, which I think even non-Christians have heard the story. Moses, you know, puts his staff down. We always picture him sort of like Gandalf or something. And the sea parts ways so that millions of people can pass through. And that same sea, when they're passed through, comes crashing down on Pharaoh and his army that, again, Pharaoh has changed his mind by this point and is tailing them. So I don't really want to get into this too much, but you really think that happened on the epic proportions that we read, right? I mean, because there's a lot of skeptics that'll say, oh, it was windy that day. And
I'll just say that there's two different, just for time's sake, I will just throw this out there. There are among evangelical scholars and archaeologists and historians, two views of the crossing. Well, really it centers on the identification of, in Hebrew, the term Yam Suf. Does that mean Sea of Reeds? Or does this mean the Red Sea? So how you identify historically and geographically what Yam Suf is, some people place it up in the Nile Delta. There's a shallow sea that was in the north. The wind could have blown and made it dry. And then the other view is that it was a large body of water. There are actually two fingers of the Red Sea from Arabia that go up into the Sinai Peninsula. One on the left is the Gulf of Suez, and the one on the right is the Gulf of Aqaba. The view that I personally hold to is that they cross somewhere in the middle of the Gulf of Aqaba at a place called Nuweiba. And it was a remarkable crossing, and it would have been just dramatic. But again, it's not, I don't think that it's necessary for salvation. So people can have different views on this. We did a podcast with Glenn Fritz, who's written a book on this. He's also appeared on Patterns of Evidence. So if people have seen the video documentary series, Patterns of Evidence, Glenn Fritz's theory was actually featured on Patterns of Evidence. But so yes, I believe that it was a miraculous crossing.
Right. And either way, if the same sea that allowed millions of people through then killed an entire army, it was epic.
And our own podcast has Ted on for an hour just talking about those points of evidence.
Yes.
From 6 months ago or so. Okay.
So we've only used 3/4 of the time to get through like the first few books, and now we have to just fly through the rest. But so let me see if I can just kind of quickly get us. They end up in this wilderness area. Moses has led them. Pretty soon into their being in the wilderness, the Israelites start complaining and they're like, what are you doing? And of course, we know that God is going to bring them to the promised land eventually, but they're like, we'd rather go back and be enslaved, which is just crazy talk to think of. And is that where we find all the stuff with the manna? And no? Is that pre-Mount Sinai, pre-Ten Commandments?
No, that's after Sinai.
Okay, so let's cover Mount Sinai then. So Moses leads the people to the base of Mount Sinai, where another covenant happens. So we've seen this amazing covenant with Abraham, but now we see a new covenant made, well, a sort of continuation with Moses and his people,
right,
where God's going to make them a kingdom of priests, and he's going to give them rules, and God's presence shows up in lightning and thunder and clouds, and then he gives them the Ten Commandments and then some other laws about justice and worship and like how to live together. And then Moses brings the commandments down to the people. They say yes, but then they do that whole golden calf thing. So maybe tell us a little bit about that and then talk us through some of the other ways that they were just really ungrateful.
The golden calf is interesting because, as I mentioned earlier, the calf was very, very important in Egypt. And I'm going to use like an old preacher phraseology here, but someone said it took one day to get God out of Egypt, but it took 40 years to get Egypt out of Israel. Mm-hmm. But that's true. And not only 40 years, it barely never left them, because in fact, here, let me just say this from a practical spiritual, well, I've got this term from Eugene Peterson, what I call spiritual theology. So a lot of times when we're going through the book of the Bible, we want to know, you know, what's this mean? What does this mean? But how does this apply to me? Let me just say this from a personal standpoint. When you're reading through the Bible and you're reading about Israel and how hard-headed they were and how, well, look at them, I would never do that. Yes, you kind of would.
Oh, I for sure 100% would. Absolutely. I would have been complaining long before they were. Totally, camping? Yeah. No, miss me with that noise.
So here's the cool thing about when, not just in the book of Exodus, but as you have other guests that talk about Israel throughout their journey with God in the Old Testament and into the New Testament, and that is that God never gives up on them. And really, that's a good lesson for us, that God doesn't give up on us. When we're hard-headed and we screw up and we mess up, God never gives up on us. In fact, we see it so much so that one of the most amazing things I've ever read in the Old Testament was God telling Hosea to go get a wife of prostitution, you know, and then go back and get her and get her and get her. So anyway, that's just a little side note. But to go back to your, I know we're getting quickly out of time here, but basically the manna from heaven, and then also the golden calf. They cry out to God. This is actually in Numbers 21. They cry out to God that they want to go back to Egypt. So God says, snakes begin to come and bite the people, which is ironic, because what is the snake representative of? Egypt. So they want Egypt. So what does God give them? He gives them Egypt, but not in the form that they want, because what does Egypt represent? Egypt represents slavery. Mm-hmm. Egypt represents death. So what is God giving? He gives them what they want. And so by giving them what they want, they die. And then one of the most bizarre episodes in the Old Testament is Moses goes before God and says, listen, the people are dying, and you get these snakes are biting everybody. And so what do I do? So then God says, here's what you do. Make a bronze snake and place it on a stake, on a pole, and hold it up high. And those who look to the serpent
and believe
by faith will be healed. Now that's bizarre, but then fast forward the clock to John 3, when Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, and Nicodemus comes to Jesus and says, you're a great teacher come from God. Nobody could do these great things unless God were with him. And then he says, a man must be born again. And then Jesus tells him, he points back to Numbers 21, and he says, just as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man shall be lifted up. Those who look to him shall live. So if you think about that, Jesus literally became a snake for us. He became a serpent. He became the very symbol of death and slavery.
That's right.
So that by faith, if you look to Christ, you will live.
I just want to say about the golden calf quickly. It wasn't that the golden calf was another god. Like the golden calf represented Yahweh. Like they were okay with that, right?
Yeah, they named it like you who brought us out of Egypt.
Yeah. So like, that's what's, I always thought they were worshiping a different god, which, I mean, they were, and idolatry was prohibited. I'm not defending them.
Let me interrupt here. They were ascribing the deliverance to that god. They were ascribing the things that God did to that god.
Oh, okay. So that's, you would say the calf was a wholly different deity.
Yes.
W-H-O. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Yes. Now, quickly, how big would the calf have been? The reason I ask is because this would have
been...
He
wants to build one in his house, but he has limited space. And
been to a sculpting iron pour. It was really fun. My brother was a sculptor for a while. And it's a lot of work to melt metal. And gold is expensive and very, very precious. And people are like, taking their earrings off and putting it into the kitty to make this thing? That's huge sacrifice. Really huge sacrifice. So just in case we gloss over it or something, they were very invested in the idea that this idol would make a difference, you know?
Well, and not to mention, I think it's interesting, we've glossed over the 10 commandments. You can go to your Bible and read them, Exodus 20, but in the 10 commandments, the first two commandments, they just break them right away. Yeah. It's like they've had it a minute and they are doing they're disobeying the first two, which is no other gods before me and don't make a idol or an image. And they do both those things.
That's right.
But again, we're just like them. So listen, there's no shade. It resonates.
In fact, the first three commandments all, I believe, had to do with addressing their Egyptian theology, religion, and how that would have played into their thinking about God. God's basically saying, I'm not like these Egyptian gods.
Right.
You treat me like these other gods because I'm not like them.
Yeah. And I'm going to skip us ahead, even though there was something else cool about that. We'll tell you in the notes, but all of this stuff happens. And then we kind of move a little bit so they're going to be caught in the wilderness for a while. And then to talk us through, there are a lot of chapters in Exodus talking about the tabernacle. Like, and if you don't think that there's any, I mean, if that doesn't excite you, those chapters are long and boring, but they don't have to be long and boring. Tell us a little bit about what the tabernacle is. Why does it matter so much? Why are we getting every detail of every piece of it?
The short answer is that God is something. Well, I'm going to give another big phraseology word here. It's called progressive revelation. So God slowly reveals himself, and he's trying to teach this people about who he is and about how to have a relationship with him. In order to do this, he gives specific instructions on what that looks like. And there's been a lot of work, and I don't agree with everything he says about this, but I do agree with probably 80% of it. Dr. John Walton. Walton, I don't agree with his conclusions, but he does talk a lot about what's called the cosmic temple.
Yep. And that love this. Say more. Yeah.
Yeah, the temple. So what is going on earth when God commands Moses and Aaron and the Levites to build the tabernacle on earth is a mirror image of what is going on in the heavens. In order for us to understand, here's the thing: God uses our imaginations. He uses our senses. He uses taste. He uses smell. He uses our eyesight. He uses everything to communicate truth to who we are. In fact, was the psalmist say, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good." Mm-hmm. So everything is a visual imagery, if you will, a drama of salvation. It's a drama of what salvation looks like. But it by itself, the blood of bulls and goats could never take away sin, but it is the faith. It's always been the faith, but there has to be some kind of content in order for the Israelites to understand the seriousness of sin. And that is that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. In fact, I would even say that to summarize what the Torah, what the law is all about, as Paul says in Galatians, that it was our tutor or our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. So when you look at all these rules and regulations like Leviticus and all this, and even the Israelites, as they looked at all these do's and don'ts and you can't do this, you do that, it will almost drive you to despair because you're like, there's no way I can do all this stuff. Exactly. You can't do it. That's the point, is that you can't do it. Well, then why did God tell them to do it anyway? Well, the point is that God is teaching them something about himself, but then what he really wants them to know, though, is that it's really what he wants is their hearts, and what he wants mm-hmm. is their faith. He just wants mm-hmm. them to trust what he says. Even if it doesn't make sense at the time, he wants them to trust what he is saying. And so by the building of the tabernacle, he's giving them instructions on a picture of what is going to go on in the heavenly realm. So it's called the cosmic temple view, but
The idea is that God's presence is there with Adam and Eve in Eden, right? Yes. His presence, that they're walking and talking, as it were, with God. But then when everything goes down and the fall happens, that presence goes away because they're kicked out of the garden. And it's not that God is no longer with his people, but not in that same intimate way. And so now God is saying to the people, I want to bring my presence and be with you. And it's going to be a traveling situation. As you travel, I'm going to travel with you in the tabernacle, which is just a temple, but in tent form, giant and all different parts and stuff. And then one day, a while later, they will make the temple where he'll also do that. But then eventually we get to the New Testament and the temple is dun, 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 us. We get to be the temple. So it's a really cool idea that starts in Genesis, gets carried into Exodus, and then we watch it unfold in the whole Bible, which that makes it a little different for me when I go back and I read about all these little parts where you're like, why does it need to be this kind of metal and goat hair and this and that? But God is paying really special attention to where his presence will be. And he does so when he chooses us to be his temples as well.
That's right.
God cares about details in worship. Worship shouldn't just be like, just show up as you are and everything. We'll just have a grand old party.
You can come as you are.
Okay. I'm not going to go off on that. But I use this as something of my sermon text this week. So I'm very dangerously going to quote this. But this has to deal with the relationship of the law that the Israelites had. And I think the fact that we think of the law, especially Old Testament law, especially not just the Ten Commandments, but everything else as well, tabernacle codes and all of that, as this horrible burden, and thank God we're free from it. But
I don't think that's how a faithful Israelite would have seen it. So this is from Psalm 147, because this is actually post-Babylonian exile. So we're looking like 1,000 years after Moses. This is Psalm 147, 19 and 20, okay? He declares his word to Jacob, his statutes and rules to Israel, parallelism there. He has not dealt thus with any other nation. They do not know his rules. Praise the Lord, or really praise Yah, or really hallelujah. So to me, it's interesting that a faithful Israelite is like, we have the law and no other nation has the law, you know, like
a source of pride.
Yeah. Yeah. And we think of it though, as thank God we don't have the law anymore,
the heavy burden.
You know, now granted the tabernacle and later temple rules and regulations and sacrifices were quite odious and the Israelites misunderstood them and et cetera. But I just think it's interesting, and I think that the as Christians, when we think about the law, we should begin with a very positive view of the law.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and we shouldn't have an attitude of Moses being this stodgy, you know, lawgiver that was a real party pooper. He was giving a gift to the people.
Yeah,
so
that's right. That's really good. And Evan, it even goes back before Psalm 102, I think it was you mentioned. It's actually in the book of Deuteronomy. God says that what other nation has the law such that you do today, and that God is so near to them as he is near to us. So it's all the way back in everything. And in fact, this is a good point to just, because I know we're about to wrap things up. What I told my Old Testament students, and I told them this years ago, and I think it still holds true today. Here's what I'll say, and this is going to sound like a bold statement, but I think it's true. Just test me on this. Check it out yourself when you're doing your own Bible study. Here it is. The Old Testament is really complex. There's a lot of stories. There's a lot of things going on. You've got Genesis all the way through Malachi, or as they say in the South, Malachi, the Italian.
No one says that, Ted. Zero people say that.
I know.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, so you've got all this stuff, and here's what I would say, that in order to understand the Old Testament, you really just need to understand the first five books of the Bible. Genesis to Deuteronomy. If you get the basic message of the first five books of the Bible, you've got the rest of the Old Testament, because it's just a play out of the rest of what God's going to say. The reason why I say that is because in Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 26, it's the if then. If you obey my voice, I will bring you into the land and I will bless you and I will make your name great and you're going to be God, all this great stuff's going to happen. But if you disobey my voice, I'm going to drive you out of the land and I'm going to bring all the plagues on you that I brought on Egypt. And so you see this played out the rest of the history of Israel.
Yep.
When they obey God, God brings in the land and God blesses them. When they disobey God, what does God do? He brings the Assyrians in 722 and then the Babylonians in 586 BC. This is just, it's just simple history. God, it goes back to something we said earlier. When God says he's going to do something, he's going to do it. You can take him at his word. So there's benefits for taking God at his word, believing what he said. And even if he said it 10,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago, you better take him at his word, because he means what he says. And he might not act on it immediately, but it's going to happen eventually. In fact, we see this in the book of Genesis, because when God says the day you eat the fruit, you're going to die. Well, that didn't happen the day, but in Genesis 5, they eventually all die. So so anyway, if you got the first five books, you've got the rest of the Old Testament, and really a key part of those first five books is the book of Exodus. And Sarah's really hit on some really great points today. And that is that it is the salvation event of the Old Testament that points to Christ. It was no accident that Jesus died on Passover. Because it was the Exodus, the Passover, all points to Christ. It all is like, this is the Passover lamb. And also the fact is the matter, he's named Yeshua, which means Joshua, which is God. He trusted God. He believed God, and God brought Israel into the land with a mighty hand. So the Exodus is all in the New Testament if we just look for it.
Now, last question for me. Deuteronomy ends with Moses not going into the promised land. He dies, and
Can't even go to the tabernacle.
And he was punished, right? But the sin he commits is in Exodus. Yes. Now, is it that the Israelites are grumbling and he gives in to them? I could never quite pinpoint it.
Okay, this goes back to something we were talking about with the tabernacle. God is earlier in their history, so he's got to sort of lay a precedent. And Moses is the man. He's the one who's been given the law, the Torah. And those who don't live by the law will what? die by the law. So he doesn't believe. What's the heart of the law? The heart of the law is to believe God. It's Deuteronomy 6 verse. What's the greatest commandment? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, to love God. And so it goes back to when they were at Rephidim, when they were at the rock, God told Moses to, what did he tell him? Speak to the rock.
Yep.
What did he do? He strikes the rock. Get this now, guy. This is really cool. So when Jesus is standing before the Sanhedrin, what do? They strike the rock, and out of the rock flows waters of living water. So Moses is acting like the Pharisees by not speaking to the rock, but by striking the rock, the Rephidim. So he doesn't believe God. And so God, because this is going to play over, because what he says in Deuteronomy 28, if you obey my voice, I'll bring you into the land. You can't enter the land. The condition on entering the land and having blessings in the land is to believe me. You got to believe me. Moses is the leader. He didn't believe me. He didn't follow my word. So therefore he doesn't enter the land. Now, is God being mean? Not necessarily, because Moses ends up in the land. And you know when that happens?
Yes. Transfiguration.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Oh, thank you.
Bingo.
Transfiguration Sunday is Sunday. I have content now. Thank you.
I have content now. Yeah. We'll preach your sermon for you. By the way, if you're confused about, I mean, Evan's question is great. And part of the reason why it's confusing is because the story that Ted just told is not in Exodus. There is a water and a rock story where he does it the right way, but the story is in Numbers 20. And it always confused me because when they would go back and talk about it, it was this great sin, but it doesn't, in the moment when you read it, sound that bad. But the way you described it, yeah, Moses takes matters into his own hands. He doesn't trust the way, because it says right here, you know, that God said, speak. And then he said, do I have to do everything? Basically, and takes the staff and strikes it. And he's kind of got his own glory going. And there's some other pieces to that story where God's like, nope.
Yeah. It's like
too big for your britches.
It's like the guy that dies because he touched the ark because it was falling and he caught it. Well, actually they were already carrying the ark in
the wrong way.
And who do the Pharisees, who do they look to as their, in fact, in the synagogues, there's even a seat of who? Seat of Moses. They looked at Moses as their authority. Mm-hmm. So the connection between the Pharisees and the Moses is what I'm trying to get to. You guys are looking confused a little bit, but that's, I'm going back to Moses speaking versus striking. And in,
this is my learning face.
The high priest, you know, when Caiaphas, when he strikes Jesus, he's doing exactly what Moses did in Rephidim. And so therefore he doesn't believe, he doesn't trust God, and he's not going to enter the land. So it's a teaching thing. So whatever goes on in the Old Testament is repeated in the New Testament. In fact, there was a study done years ago. And I know you guys may have shown the slide. I think it was done by two guys in Great Britain. There are 64,000 references in the New Testament to the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So that the reason why that's important is because people today, most of us New Testament Christians, will read the New Testament, go, you know, that's Old Testament stuff, you know, doesn't make any sense. But 64,000 references to the Old Testament. So what that tells me is that if I want to understand the New Testament in its fullest context, then I need to go back and look at some of the Old Testament stuff as well.
Hmm. Let me say one final thing as we're getting ready to close out. And that is, you talked about God saying, if you do things this way, there will be blessing. And if you don't do things this way, you'll get taken over. And of course, we see that with Assyria and Babylon and onward. But I think it's interesting when we talked in Genesis about the covenant that God made with Abraham, he made the covenant knowing it would be broken and basically saying, let it be to these dead animals that were along the way. Let it be to me as it is to these animals. Should somebody break this covenant, knowing full well it would be the other guy, because God doesn't break his covenant. And he does the same thing with Moses when he makes the covenant. He is committing himself again. He's like re-upping with a people that he knows are going to break it. And there's something really beautiful to that, because just like you said, we are like the complaining Israelites all the way into present day. And God is committed to us in covenant, knowing that we're going to screw things up. And yet there's a rescue. There's always a rescue. And I just want to end on that note, because there's so many like sort of terrible things that happen in Exodus, but they're all leading toward, I mean, God does it for them, and he does it all through the Bible, and he does it for us. Rescue, always forgiveness, always compassion, slow to anger, abounding with love, right? So I think that's just maybe a final note to, as we're thinking about like snakes and blood sacrifices and things. God never leaves us.
The Hebrew word that's used throughout the Sarah, that what you're referring to is the Hebrew word hesed or chesed.
Yes.
It's God's covenant faithfulness. It's love. It's that God gives you something that you didn't deserve, that we don't deserve it. Israelite didn't deserve it. You know, people go, well, Israel, they're hard-headed. Yeah, well, so are we. You know, God doesn't ever give up on us.
Amen. Well, we actually did it in not too much more than an hour. So praised be. Where can people find you if they want to hit you up for more fascinating tidbits about archaeological things?
Sure thing. They can go to our website, epicarchaeology.org, which we are renovating at the time, got some new stuff coming online. And then also our YouTube channel, Epic Archaeology YouTube channel. And we have a new video that's dropping this coming Friday on Islamic archaeology, which is really fascinating stuff.
Cool.
And then also we have our Facebook page as well. People can follow us on Facebook, and we're also on Instagram as well.
And on your YouTube channel, is that where the video is about the third commandment? Because I think that's cool, and I think people should go watch it. It's just a short video. It's like 7 minutes long, and it's a whole new way of thinking about the third commandment that you have never probably thought of before. So go check that out.
Which third commandment?
The take the Lord's name in vain. Don't do it.
We have a different one. So
what?
We don't. Lutherans tend to bundle the first two and then separate
Lutherans.
The last two.
You make everything so confusing.
So for us, the third is the Sabbath day, but for you, it's the blasphemy. Or not for you, but I mean, for many people.
I mean,
people,
like in the Bible, blasphemy. It's the third. So yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Idolatry is not a problem anymore. Don't we know this?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, okay, on that note, you can find us at HoustonTOT.com. Keep listening, subscribe, maybe rate us and review us. But until we see or hear from you again, we encourage you as always to question freely, think deeply, and disagree as needed.